Welcome to Asimov's Spotlight. Here now, another story selected from the pages of Asimov's science fiction magazine.
In this May-June installment of our podcast, we have a fascinating alternate history where gods are very much real and being held captive in zoos. Please enjoy Evan Marcroft's Pax Mongolica, read by the author himself.
Anubis's eyes are playbear eyes, button brown and just as deep. There are fleas in the fur around them. I zoom in with my camera to watch them map the god in lines of red bites. I snap a picture and those eyes capture me in their mud. I wave at him from the other side of the bars. He blinks back at me and then peels black lips away from a trap of yellow teeth and a canine yawn. I feel neither blessed nor damned, only seen like 2,000 visitors per day. I guess the stories about him aren't true then. If he recognizes me as a child of the land below the Aegean, he doesn't seem to care. I step away from the enclosure to let a group of school kids crowd together and gawk. They're from the Kazakh Khanate, going by the accent that bleeds through my iPhone's translation of their chatter. I'm more awed by their wonder at the god than by the god itself. Everything is still special to them, and I miss that. The zoo's tour guide comes up behind me, trying to lure the kids into being interested in her routine. Her name tag reads, "Hi, I'm Borta," like the great Khagan's first wife. "This specimen was captured in the Sinai Desert of Mamluk Khanate," she says, "and relocated here in 601 AG. Anubis was worshipped as a god of the underworld by the indigenous peoples of that region. His diet consists primarily of camel meat, and he can eat more than 150 pounds a day. Can you guess how much he weighs?" Olivia touches my arm. "What did you think?" I scramble around for something cool to say, because I really want her to think I'm cool. "I'd like to see the kind of cats he chases." "You'd know better than I do." Her touch becomes a playful punch. "No, seriously. What does it make you feel? Really, I'd like to know." "I don't know," I say. "I guess I ought to have brought a prayer. It would have been more respectful. But the ones he'd know are all in cats and eyes. I don't speak the language." I decided to go to the zoo out of procrastination more than anything. I was in the middle of a thesis on the historical role of gods in warfare, particularly between 100 BG and 200 AG, and figured it would be a more enjoyable excuse to not have to actually write the thing. Failing that, it might at least be a world-expanding experience. I hadn't been up to Karkorum since my dad took me when I was 5 to see the crowning of the new Khagan. I heard they'd had great bars, though the phrase Mongolian microbrewery still doesn't hit my ear right. It takes me only 9 hours total to get there from Cairo by maglev train. It would have been less if I hadn't taken a spontaneous detour to Moscow and Rus Khanate to sightsee around the tomb of Batu Khan and check out his preserved body on display. He doesn't look too bad for an 800-year-old with paraffin cheeks. I arrive in Karkorum a hair after the zoo's operating hours, so I kill time tooling around the food trucks outside the two-man Amgalan Ward, closed to the public except for daily tours. The silver tree at the city center is mobbed by visitors even more touristy than I am, but that is only a reproduction anyway. I spend the night in the Urzdag Ul Hostel downtown, and show up at the Karkorum Daylogical Park an hour or so after opening, with only a small hangover. The zoo looks old, but not in a deliberate way, like an antique. Much of the city is like that, artificially antiquated, its cobbled streets propped up against the rising tide of asphalt. Buildings remain low and terracotta shingled by city ordinance. Karkorum is ever struggling not to be conquered by those it has conquered. Falafels and tapas and Sino-Byzant fusion are doing what whole armies never could. A high brick wall crenellated with bishi and other stone animals surrounds the perimeter of the facility, coming together into two arched iron gates, a single-person ticket office between them. Naturally, the line to get in snakes away and loops around the courtyard fountain, where a bronze dagon spews an infinite parabola of water from a grouper's pout. I fall in behind a pale girl with a curtain of red-gold hair going around her head, like her face is too cute to show off without a ticket. When she twists about to fix the buckle on her satchel, that curtain parts, and I see that it is. I know instantly that I must talk to her, or the regret will stalk me all the way back to Cairo. Life is too short not to say hello. First time here? I ask, before she could turn back around. She glances up at me, a little startled. Oh, yes it is. And yourself? My iPhone straightens her slippery consonants into something intelligible, but her northern accent bleeds through, thick as butter and sweet as sugar. Second time. But I was little then. I don't remember anything. What made you want to come? She presses her bag flat against her stomach. Same as most people, I think. I want to see my gods, and this is where they happen to be. That's all. What about you? Homework. I'm mind-blowing my brains out. That gets a laugh that makes me feel 6 inches taller. Tarek, I say. Mamluk on it. Olivia, she replies. Polska. That's an odd, antiquated thing to call Bela Khanet. What, does she go around calling southern Mongolia Jungwal? But I've got the sense not to mention it. I keep up the small talk as the line retracts into the gate like a tongue. When the ticket office catches up to us, Olivia unsheathes her wallet and tells the lady there it'll be 2. Oh, no, I say. You don't have to do that. Sure I do, she says, handing over the right amount of chow. I'd like to talk to you a little longer. Now you feel guilty if you don't hang out with me. It's difficult not to tell her that I'd have done that for free. The Mongolian ticket lady gives us a look. An unchaperoned boy and girl together tends to rankle the older conservative types. But she lets us in anyway. Once inside, we stop at the big map of the park to get our bearings. The layout corresponds roughly to the geographic origins of the specimens. East Asiatic gods in the east, and so forth. The air smells of guano spritzed with popcorn butter, of wet pelts and rainbow of incense. It lures up to my eyes a deep-diving memory of walking half as tall as I do now down a cedar-shaded path, my hands sweating inside my dad's, of offering my stick of pink candy floss to an incurious giant with the head of a ram. What did you want to see first? I ask. Olivia looks around, squinting, like she hadn't thought it through until now. You're from Mamluk Khanate, right? Let's go over that way. I don't know anything about your gods. My gods? Since when? Weird, but I let it slide. Right this way, ma'am. So we go see Anubis with his chocolate drop eyes, and Ahmet in her wallow, and then this nearby Sekhmet, who is less a giant woman in a cat mask than a lioness in the skin of a woman. We stop to admire Osiris, and it is disconcerting to see him behind bars on account of how human he appears. But when you look through the binoculars, you'll see his evergreen skin resolve into a coat of fine scales, and his eyes, too, are only as deep as chalk illusion. And it isn't like he talks or anything. We blink photos through our iPhones, and I feel snippets of my paper begin to click into place. The battles of Central Asia proved gods to be an invaluable and revolutionary military asset, the equivalent of mobile armor owing to their strength and size. The intelligent deployment of a god was in fact one of the only reliable counters to the mounted archers of the Golden Horde. Indeed, Mamluk Khanate might have been known by a very different name had Sultan Qutuz not surrendered to Hulagu at Ain Jalut. So you really don't feel anything seeing the men there? Olivia asks skeptically. Sheepishly I say, not really, to be honest. Those are your gods. Is this a test? I ask. I came here to get away from school. It absolutely is, she primly replies. Tick-tock. I guess I used to, I admit, but that was a long time ago. I mean, Anubis hadn't been a god of my people since a long time before Hulagu showed up. Some kids like dinosaurs. I'm sure that back then, having the Mongolian army roll up on you was a whole apocalyptic thing. A lot of people's ancestors became would-be ancestors, and thousands of wooded wives wailed in the skies, a wave of pillage and death swept from sea to sea on horseback, running down gods that had fled from defeat and taking them for trophies. For the prototype of this very zoo. But these days, centuries removed from the screams and stink blood, I can only think of that period in sports terms. One team crushed the other at the big game and ran off with their big furry mascots. Mine threw in the towel before the game even started. These days, I'm not sure what team I'm a part of. My names are Egyptian and Mongolian in equal proportion. So they're animals to you, Olivia says, a tad accusingly. I guess I fail, I ask, a little lamely. Olivia shrugs. No, it's no difference to me, I just think it's a little crazy that more people don't see them the way I do. The way that I see it, each cage here is for a piece of someone's history, their culture. Well, sure, I admit. But you know they're safe here, and you can always come see them. That's true. For a ticket fee, anyway, she says, ruefully. It's not a cage if you don't want them, I counter. She stiffens visibly. And who is it that gets to say who does or doesn't, hmm? Did you decide you didn't want your gods, or was it some horde general 800 years ago? We keep walking, but it's as though there's a little storm cloud above her. Invisible, but for the shadow it casts on her expression. I'm screwing this up for sure. Hey, I say, let's go see your gods. I'd like to know what kind of animal heads they have. Olivia nods and the sun peeks back out. Okay, but you're going to be disappointed. They're mostly just bigger us. We cut through Middle Asia on the way back to the northwest, passing beneath domed enclosures in which seraphim captured in the Kani north of mine perch and preen, and chatter in mimic Hebrew. The bars of their cages crackle with power when you listen into the right kind of quiet. It takes more than wrought iron to keep a god in. These are not hers, but Olivia gazes up at them with appreciative wonder anyway. I mostly gaze at her. She's the kind of gorgeous you forgive for burning down your house because the flames backlit her so nicely. She scowls, though, as we pass a pair of Mongolian teenagers in Norse punk regalia hurling taunts and popcorn at the blood-red bull thing pacing anxiously in the pit below. It paws the rim of the ditch, going around its little island as if wanting nothing more than to leap out and silence them on its horns. Look at these jerks, I mutter. I thought you didn't care about the gods, Olivia says, like she's caught me on a lie in court. I throw up my hands, disarmed by her rapier logic. Just because I don't feel a connection doesn't mean I don't care. I'd call a guy out if I caught him pissing in a Grecian urn. It still means something. I can see you're trying not to laugh. Well, thank you, Tarek. I appreciate you saying that. Further up ahead, a group of men and women in white shawls is gathered around a large enclosure in a politely quiet paean. The smell of incense grows sewerishly thick. The park is more than a preservation. It is a centralized temple for the faiths that make a patchwork quilt of an otherwise seamless empire. The Golden Horde had been all for religious freedom, so long as it was under supervision, under their terms. Long before it was this zoo, exactly, people had come here from all over to pay tribute and beg blessings. Does it ever do anything? Who knows what miracles the gods spin up after closing time, when the godkeepers aren't looking. That isn't really the point of religion, I say. What matters isn't that you hear them, but that they hear you. They're from Polska, too, Olivia remarks. I recognize that song. I have to ask, why do you call it that? She shrugs. Force of habit. It's the only thing my father ever called it. I think he lived half in the time before. I don't need to ask, before what? When I was still young to be tucked in at night, she goes on, he would love to tell me the stories we told back then. God stories, especially. He'd keep me up past my bedtime with them. He knew so many of them, from his own father, who got them from his. There was Leshy of the forest, who called game up for hunters in need, but might lure a child off if he strayed too far into the dark of the world. If a woman went to labor in a dangerous place, she could call on Mukos to protect her. You and me, we all live on the same planet, but these stories helped to make our history belong only to us. It didn't matter if they were true or not. These things had happened to us, no one else. I don't say it, but I think I kind of get it. A history where Rusalka roamed the rivers and the world is a tree, the history of an alien world, one where Karkarum is a jumble of syllables like baby talk. I think of my own mythology, where the god of the sun fights every day to protect it from a snake as big and hungry as the universe. It doesn't sound like Earth to me either, but these days I can go watch Ra peck the eyes out of a feed carcass between the hours of 10 and 5, and the sun beating down on us now belongs to everyone. My father loved to tell me god stories, Olivia adds, but his favorite were war stories. I didn't hear those until I was older, of course, otherwise Mama would have yelled. Like how at the Battle of Legnica, the black god Chernabog crushed the 50 invaders with a hammer of stone defending Prince Henrik at his retreat. Even at the end, they were fighting to keep our world for us. I bet everywhere you go there's a story like that. What I don't say is that they are only proud stories because they end them before the history books do. The unspoken conclusion hanging off each like a silent letter, pronounced only as a wince, is that the Golden Horde still won. It could have been different, I suppose. The smallest twitch of a finger can send time's arrow far off course. I wonder sometimes what might have happened had our sultan not met Hulagu at Ain Jalut and knelt, had not yielded our gods to his army. If my ancestors had chosen to fight, hopeless as it seemed, instead of joining the horde to rampage all over the land above and below the Aegean, who knew what stories we'd be telling these days? We're at the cage now, beside the prayer group. I peer into the evergreen shadows. The figure squats there, back turned to us, oblivious to its own worship. Who is that handsome fellow, I ask? That's Perun, the Sky Father, the King of the Gods. It might be the sound of his name, or the patter of a squirrel darting through the trees, or anything at all. The god stirs and cranes his neck to glance blearily at the crowd behind him. He looks entirely human, albeit three times as large and massive. As the wind rummages through the pines and jostles their boughs, blurts and jags of sunlight reveal the varicose veins that riddle his ancient flesh like blue roots, the melanomas dotting his wrinkled back. In the stories my father told, he was 50 feet tall, Olivia murmurs. In battle he can hurl thunderbolts as if scattering seed across a field. I look the god up and down, but he is certainly far smaller than that. A spark leaps brightly between the hairs of its frazzled beard, but that is hardly the lightning that blew apart armies, easily dismissed as a symptom of bioelectrogenesis. I wonder if they were greater in the past. Olivia crinkles her brow. How do you mean? I mean more like the stories, I say. Bigger, you know, smarter. Maybe there was a time when they really were all that your dad said. And then something changed. I don't know. Or perhaps we just made up stories about these big, weird animals. I propose only to myself. The adventures we all took our stuffed animals on didn't actually happen, did they? But they did take us away from a world we had to share with other people, to prove the lie that we were special. Captivity. Olivia stares hard at the king of the gods as he gnaws disinterestedly on the gristly femur of some feed animal, pruned with a heap of tires to keep him entertained. If you're right, that was it. Take them out of the world, and all we have is each other. All they have is themselves. And that isn't enough. I think some things would atrophy in both of us. The flower's prettiest when it's still on the stem. Cut it off, and soon all you have is a dried-out bookmark to help you remember the better thing by. She shrugs her bag higher on her shoulder. I think my father is right about this place, she says, with bitter medicine melting on her tongue. It's a prison of stories. The great Khan put her gods in here, so it would be his world alone. You say your father used to tell stories, I say. How did he die, if you don't mind me asking? He didn't die. He came here, and then he stopped telling stories. A bovine scream cuts our conversation in half. Those Norse punk idiots are still at it. I figure one of them must have thrown a rock because the bowl thing in the pit is hollering exactly like I'd be hollering if I'd taken a rock to the eye. I cut my hands around my mouth and shout, "Hey, you two, knock it off." The two ran on me like I said something about their mothers. One's got long braids, dyed blonde, and runic gibberish tattooed up his arms, and the other has an iron nasal pierced into the bridge of his nose. "Shut up, sand dog," the braided one hollers back. "Mind your own business." I let the slur roll over me like a breeze. 300 years ago, being too brown was a great way to get your butt kicked. But in an era of civil rights, I have no incentive to tolerate their nonsense. "Why don't you leave it alone? What's it doing to you, huh?" "Leave it," Olivia sighs, tugging on my arm. "It's not worth starting a fight." The bull thing comes up over the railing like a breaching whale, and hits the dirt behind the two punks with a thunderclap. It must be 3 meters at the shoulder, bigger if measured from the tips of its black horns, and everything below an undulating block of vermilion muscle. Even so, I can't imagine how it could have jumped that high on nearly conical legs. The crowd of pilgrims stop singing and start screaming, and scatter like a flock of spooked doves. My body thinks faster than my brain. I'm grabbing Olivia around the shoulders and carrying her in the direction opposite the god before I finished being awestruck by it. Out of the corner of my eye, I see the braided punk go stumble running off with his baggy pants around his ankles. I watch the god catch his slower friend between its horns and hurl him flailing and screaming overhead. I look away and run as it catches him in its grass-grinding jaws. That's what they get for picking on Moloch the child-eater, I think to myself, but not happily. The god-keepers come and find us by the gift shop when it's all over. As soon as we'd cleared the area, they'd come in with their god-killing guns and destroy the thing. It hadn't taken more than 5 minutes from start to finish. There was no way to get it safely into its pen, and besides, it had killed a person. There was no other choice to argue about. The police will be here shortly, they tell us, and a security camera had caught us fleeing the scene. They want to know if he'd be willing to stick around here a while longer to give our account of what happened, since the cameras couldn't see everything. They say it in a way that tells me I don't really have a choice. I say, "Sure, no problem," and Olivia gives me a strangely panicky look at that, but she doesn't say no either. So they lead us across the park towards the administration building. As we pass the decorative pond at the center of the zoo, I watch Olivia quickly dip her hand into her bag and wing something into the water while the guards' backs are turned. She looks at me with wide, terrified eyes, and I agree automatically not to say a word. We sit down with the cops and tell them exactly what we saw. The punks were taunting the god, and eventually the god had enough and jumped his enclosure. The whole time I'm watching Olivia Neese tremble under the table. Any second, someone will bust in to say that a camera caught her throwing something suspicious in the pond, but nobody does. We're let go after 20 minutes with a thank you for our time and an apology for having to see all that. We sit down on the rim of the fountain outside the front gate to decompress. Olivia doesn't walk away, but she doesn't talk either. She's got a secret, and she's trying to keep it from coming up like an upset stomach. I decide to just ask. So, what did you throw in the pond? The bomb, she says, looking seasick. I was about to get drugs, I say. You made a bomb? No, she says, my dad did. He's great at that stuff, and it's not really a bomb. I mean, it's just... it's supposed to short out a god cage, that's all. Nothing blows up. My job was to plant it on Prune's cage, knock it out, let the god go free. Like he's meant to be. Her father, the Liberator. You hear about them every now and then. Men and women nursed on stories of old glory, now claustrophobic in an empire grown too huge, too everywhere. I let out a low whistle. That's 10 to 15 at Tahar if you're caught. The ball's on you, must drag when you walk. That got an involuntary cough of laughter. Yeah, I have to carry them around in my bag. How did you plan on planning the thing without me seeing? I mean, I was right there. She buries her face in her hands. I really don't know. I think you were my excuse not to. I let her cry for a while. I can tell by the sound it's more stress than anything. It's just, we've been planning this so long, you know. It took ages to talk myself up to it. And he wanted it so bad, just to see Perun go free again. And now I know that even if I did let them all out, they'd just be shot. I guess it is kind of a different world now, I say. I've managed to grin, but I hope she doesn't take too close a look at it. She doesn't look at me at all. Please, don't say anything more. I'm sorry, I'll be okay in a minute. There's no worse feeling than standing by with your nuts in your hands while a girl sobs herself dry, but sometimes the best thing you can do is nothing. When I'm sure she's tapped out, I sidle a little closer and say, you look like you need a coffee. The fact that she'd been carrying a bomb around this whole time is a red flag you could sail a galleon with, but I'm 23 and she's still cute. She glances up from her hands, her palms blue and black and red with teary makeup. Her bangs are frazzled and there's a fat slug of snot going down her lip. I don't want to know what that looks like, says the girl from the other side of the world with a feeble smile. And I think if old Genghis Khan hadn't conquered half the planet and poached everyone's gods, I probably wouldn't have met her. If my people had stood and fought in Ain Jalut, then she and I might yet be unconquered peoples, children of free and disparate worlds speaking non-interoperable languages, living mutually exclusive histories. Never would we have met under the cool shadow of oppression and spoken to one another in the tongue of our common master. My father and definitely her father and all their fathers would likely disagree, and fairly enough, but I think that makes up for all the bad stuff. I take Olivia by her stickiest hand and I remember that I've forgotten all about my paper. It's fine. History isn't going anywhere. In the now, Karkarim glitters without gods. It prays to itself in every language. Yesterday's tyrants are gone to marble, and from the ground you can hardly see their faces. In their shade, we go to help write stories that everyone will know, and hopefully make out a little.
Thanks for listening to Asimov's Spotlight, a feature of Asimov's Science Fiction Magazine. If you liked what you've heard, consider subscribing to Asimov's. We're available in print and digital. And please stop by again next month to hear another exciting story chosen from our pages.